And good morning. Hope you're having a wonderful Thursday. I'm Kevin Dietz, bringing you the headlines and the stories that everyone is talking about today. And today, a lot of people are talking about Anthony Fauci. I watched what happened with Dr. Anthony Fauci, and I came away with two thoughts that can both be true at the same time. First, the Fifth Amendment is a constitutional right. It exists for a reason. If your attorneys believe you could expose yourself to criminal liability, even if you've received a pardon for some things, they're probably going to tell you, don't answer. And if Dr. Fauci believes there are legal risks that aren't covered by his pardon, or if he's worried that his testimony could create new legal exposure, then invoking the Fifth Amendment is a right guaranteed by the Constitution. According to reports, Fauci invoked that right repeatedly throughout the hearing. I don't criticize someone simply for exercising a constitutional protection, but here's my other thought. Legal rights and moral obligations are not always the same thing. And that's where I struggle. COVID changed the world. More than a million Americans died. Businesses closed, schools shut down. Children lost years of normal childhood. People died alone in hospitals. Families couldn't attend funerals. People lost careers. Mental health suffered. Trust in public institutions was shaken. Whether you believe every government decision was justified, whether you believe mistakes were made, whether you think Fauci got most things right or most things wrong, one thing is beyond debate. The American people deserve honest answers. Not because we're looking for revenge, not because we're looking for political theater, because we're trying to make sure it never happens again. That's the purpose of oversight. Congress shouldn't simply be interested in assigning blame. Congress should be asking what worked, what failed, what information did we have, what information did we miss? Would we make the same decisions again? If another pandemic starts tomorrow, and someday another one probably will, we cannot afford to repeat mistakes simply because nobody was willing to explain what happened. That's why transparency matters. Now, some people will say today's hearing was political. Maybe parts of it were. Some Democrats argued exactly that. Some Republicans clearly believe crimes were committed. Reasonable people can disagree about the motivations of the committee. But the questions themselves, those are legitimate. Americans deserve to know how decisions were made. They deserve to understand why guidance changed over time. They deserve explanations for school closures, masking recommendations, vaccine messaging, travel restrictions, and every other major policy that affected our daily lives. History isn't written by avoiding questions. It's written by answering questions. Now, I understand Fauci's position. If his lawyers believe every answer could become evidence in another prosecution, if they believe his pardon doesn't protect every possible legal issue, then from a legal standpoint, remaining silent may have been the safest choice. That's what defense attorneys often recommend. But here's the problem. Silence may protect you legally. It doesn't help the country heal. It doesn't rebuild trust. It doesn't answer the questions millions of Americans still have today. And perhaps most importantly, it doesn't help us prepare for the next crisis. This should not be about Anthony Fauci. It should not be about Rand Paul. It should not be about Donald Trump or Joe Biden. It should be about the American people, because the next pandemic won't care who's in the White House. The next virus won't ask whether you're Republican or Democrat. When that day comes, we'll need public health leaders that the country can trust. We'll need government agencies that the public believes. And trust only comes from transparency. So yes, the Constitution gives every American the right to remain silent. But after everything this country endured during COVID, the American people also deserve the truth, not for punishment, but for preparation. Because the lessons we failed to learn today could become the lives we lose tomorrow. We're going to take your calls on this at 9:30. The number is 1-800-859-0957, 1-800-859-0WJR. I was driving into work today, and there was a huge sign up on a bridge on I-75 that said, "Fund healthcare, not war." This, as a new Associated Press NORC survey finds, about two-thirds of adults believe the Iran war has not been worth the cost. Marie Osborne is following that story and joins us now. Good morning, Marie.
And good morning, Kevin. And the poll also found that this skepticism was stretching well beyond Democrats and independents, reaching a sizable share of Republicans as well. The findings come as this conflict enters its sixth month. It follows this recent pause in hostilities after an escalation that left additional American service members dead. Public support for President Trump's handling of Iran has softened. The poll shows approval of his approach slipping to 28%. It's down from 34%. That was a month ago. Among Republicans, support remains higher at 37%, but it has edged downward as the conflict continues. The survey also points to little appetite for prolonged military campaign. Only about 2 in 10 Americans favor continuing military operations, while larger numbers preferred renewed ceasefire talks or a complete halt to military action. Pocketbook concerns, just like you mentioned, Kevin, they're playing a major role. Roughly 7 in 10 Americans say preventing higher gas prices is a top priority as fuel costs and broader inflation continue to weigh on household budgets. And at the same time, strong majorities say it's important to keep Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon and to pursue a lasting ceasefire.
Yeah, it seems like this is definitely an issue that's going to be on the mind of voters as they go into both this primary election here on Tuesday and then again in November. It's a really good debate. Because it is our tax dollars that are being spent, and decisions have to be made because there's a limited number of them to spend. And I think it's a good, healthy discussion.
It absolutely is. You've talked to the candidates. I don't know how many of them are even touching on this topic. I mean, especially Republicans, they're going to have to live with this decision to continue with this conflict. So they're at the polls, they're going to have to live with the results of that. I wonder how they really feel about that.
Yep, we're going to have John James on at 9:18. He's running for governor. He's currently a congressional member of the 10th District. We'll ask him about
it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, thanks, Marie. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
Yeah, another poll, a new CNN poll, finds that nearly 3/4 of Americans believe President Donald Trump is not paying enough attention to the country's most important problems. According to the survey, 73% of U.S. adults say Trump is focused on the wrong priorities, while 27% believe he's giving the right issues enough attention. The poll also found weaker public marks for Trump's handling of issues, including the economy, inflation, gas prices, and Iran. CNN says the findings represent the highest level of concern it has measured over whether Trump's priorities align with the issues Americans care about most. The survey also suggests enthusiasm among Republicans has softened compared with earlier in Trump's presidency. The Grand Traverse County Sheriff's Office says it has not yet opened a criminal investigation into the newly released Interlochen School of the Arts report detailing decades of alleged sexual abuse. Sheriff Michael Shea says investigators only have the publicly released redacted version of the report, and they need additional information to identify potential victims or suspects. Shea says if victims come forward or investigators receive more detailed information, the sheriff's office will work with prosecutors to determine whether criminal cases can move forward. Grand Traverse County Prosecutor's Office has confirmed it received the report, but says it has not yet completed its review. The Interlochen report alleges nearly 50 adults in leadership roles sexually abused or exploited at least 70 students over several decades based on approximately 180 interviews with former students and staff. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk with John James. He's running for governor, and then we're going to take your calls, 1-800-859-0WJR. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. It's All Talk on a Thursday morning. I'm Kevin Dietz coming to you from the Golden Tower of the Fisher Building. Congressman John James is serving his second term representing Michigan's 10th Congressional District and now is the Republican candidate for governor. Just days ago, he stood alongside President Donald Trump during the president's visit to Michigan. He has Trump's endorsement in what is expected to be one of the nation's most closely watched governor races, and he joins us now. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Yeah, I'm here. Just Chris Carlson State must have hit a bad patch in reception. We'll get that fixed when I get elected. How about that?
Not a problem. Glad to have you with us. Yeah, hey, how important is that endorsement of the president, and how important is that relationship with the president when you become governor?
Well, I'm proud to have the president's endorsement. He's been a friend for quite some time, and he endorsed me because he knows that we have to work together to beat Jocelyn Benson and stop the march of Marxism through our state. He cares about Michigan deeply. He cares about bringing our jobs back, and he knows that I'm the best one to do that. And so now I'm out here trying to earn your support and your vote by communicating a message that proven leadership matters and results matter. And I'm excited for what the future holds.
Yeah, I think that endorsement probably knocked Mike Cox out of the primary, and Mike Cox endorses you as well. Are you finding his people supportive of your ideas?
Well, I have to earn the vote of every single Michigander, and it starts in the primary. I'm honored to have Mike Cox's endorsement. I'm honored to have Tom Leonard's endorsement. I'm honored to have Eric Nesbitt's endorsement, and I'm honored to have the president's endorsement. Now, again, getting out there and communicating how we're all going to come together, unify behind beating the crazies with common sense, how we're going to focus on things that are going to increase our economic growth, put more money in your pocket, and make sure we fix our education system so our children can stay in Michigan. Those are the things that we're all focused on doing, and I'm excited for the opportunity.
There's a couple of polls out that are interesting regarding the president. 73% of U.S. adults say Trump is focused on the wrong priorities. Two-thirds believe the Iran war is not worth the money. Do you think the president is going in the right direction?
Look, this is going to be the 25th anniversary of 9/11, but it seems like too many people have forgotten when we pledged never to forget. But also within that 25 years, there were kids who graduated from college who weren't even born when we all watched those planes crash into the towers. Now the mayor of New York is somebody who sympathizes with extremists. It seems like too many people have forgotten. Our president hasn't forgotten. You haven't forgotten. And we need to make sure that America is always safe, always strong, and Iran never has a nuclear weapon. Not just having a nuclear weapon, that when they say death to America, they mean it. Trust me, I went over to the Middle East and fought extremists that were trained by Iranians. It's the Houthi rebels, the Hezbollah, Hamas. These are entities, they're proxies that can hit us. And as recently as a couple weeks ago, you had someone who was radicalized, who terrorized Temple Israel right up the street, guys. This is something that is very serious. The president's taking it seriously. And as a combat vet who's seen evil face to face, we must never be vulnerable. We must always be strong, and we must never forget.
Speaking on that issue, we've had some big wins out at Selfridge. You and others have gotten the support we need. How important is that to the safety and security of Michigan?
Yeah, so I'm really excited about this one. I was able to help deliver nearly $300 million passed through the House for Selfridge, in addition to working with the president to get a new fighter mission for Selfridge. When I first got to Congress, they were talking about shutting down Selfridge Air National Guard base, which would have been a massive blow not only to our national security, but to our state's economy. And President Trump is a promise keeper. He said that we're going to get very fast planes, and within the first 100 days, we got a guarantee for the F-15EX. In addition to that, the House authorized the military to spend $450 million to improve and update Selfridge Air National Guard base to prepare for a new fighter mission and extend the life of the base. This is more than generational. A generation is about 20 years. This is something that's going to be 50 years or longer. We are so excited to have this additional opportunity, new life into Southeast Michigan, and an additional opportunity for us to defend our nation and make sure that Michigan remains at the forefront of investment.
Let's talk about Michigan. Governor Whitmer has had 8 years. What grade would you give Governor Whitmer, and why?
Oh, I would say that the most important grade is the fact that our population is voting with its feet, because we're 45th out of 50 in education. Our economic situation has declined from the teens until the 30s or 40s, and our roads still aren't fixed. The grade really it matters the most, not from me, but from the people who've lost hope, from our children who are leaving. And for our future, that seems to be flying away. I'm running to focus on affordability of lowering our taxes, making sure we have lower healthcare costs, lower energy costs, lower housing costs by addressing the situation that we have here that makes it so difficult for people to have transparency and control over their own lives and more money in their pocket. I'm running for public safety when activist judges, DAs, and prosecutors let violent repeat offenders back on our street to terrorize innocent people. I'm running on fixing our education system, to hold the system accountable for failing our children over and over and over for decades and decades and decades, focusing on literacy and focusing more on academics and activism. These are all failures of her administration, and the worst grade is the fact that our population has been stagnant for her entire time in office.
Why do you think her approval rating is so high? And I ask because the governor's probably going to endorse Jocelyn Benson if she hasn't already, and I wonder how much of a bump that might give Jocelyn Benson in a general election versus your Donald Trump endorsement.
Well, that remains to be seen. But again, we are I'm up in the polls by double digits in the primary, and I'm the only one who can beat Jocelyn Benson in the general. And recent polls, even from the MEA, have me within striking distance of Jocelyn Benson after my primary opponents have spent over $30 million in their campaigns, mostly attacking me. When we get the truth out there, when we tell the truth when they're lying about us, people will see the opportunity that I have the skills that I've developed in combat, bringing people together to accomplish tough missions. Michigan's going to need that. I have the skill set growing jobs in Michigan, specifically Detroit, so that people can have better lives and livelihoods. My opponents don't have that skill set. And then also in a state where 40% of our budget comes from the federal government, and I can pick up the phone and call the president and a number of his cabinet secretaries, making sure that we are at the front of the line and not the back of the line when it comes to the needs of Michigan. These are all skills that a governor should have. These are all resources that a governor should have. And no one in this race on either side can say that they have had the occasion to develop the skill set to understand what it takes to put Michigan in a better situation. So, again, we're running on proven leadership results, and I believe those matter.
Give us the website, John.
JohnJamesMI.com, or you can follow us on socials, JohnJamesMI. Thank you so much.
All right, John James, running for governor. The primary is Tuesday. Thanks so much for your time. Good luck down the stretch. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. And it is 9:35. That means it is your turn to talk. 1-800-859-0957, 1-800-859-0WJR. Give us a call. Give us a text. Be a part of the show. Hey, Michigan voters, they're just days away from choosing the candidates who will battle to replace Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and this could be one of the most important elections the state has seen in years. Republicans are deciding between Congressman John James and businessman Perry Johnson, while Democrats are led by Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, who has also received several high-profile endorsements. What qualities matter most to you here? Experience, business success, electability, conservative candidates, or are Democrats offering the better direction for Michigan? I want to hear from you guys what you think about these endorsements. I found this kind of interesting. John James, he got Donald Trump's endorsement, and that is a huge deal in the primary. Donald Trump's support means a lot because his base will back who Donald Trump tells him to back. But Donald Trump's popularity is not great. A couple of polls out this morning, two-thirds of Americans think the president is not focusing on the right issues. Two-thirds of Americans think the Iran war is not worth the money and we should be spending that money elsewhere. And then Jocelyn Benson, she's going to have the endorsement of Gretchen Whitmer. How popular is Gretchen Whitmer? Well, in the state of Michigan, she's still very popular. Even though no one in Michigan can read, everybody's moving out of Michigan. We're not making as much money as people in other states, but still people like Gretchen Whitmer. What does that mean, those two endorsements? Is one of those endorsements better than the other endorsement? Will a Gretchen Whitmer endorsement go farther than a Donald Trump endorsement in the general election? I know in the primary, it's not going to matter. Jocelyn Benson's going to get in. She doesn't need any endorsement. She's in. John James, the endorsement of Donald Trump is going to help. It knocked Mike Cox out of the race, and it will help with his run against Perry Johnson. It's going to be interesting. This is what John James said about the endorsement of Donald Trump.
Well, I'm proud to have the president's endorsement. He's been a friend for quite some time, and he endorsed me because he knows that we have to work together to beat Jocelyn Benson and stop the march of Marxism through our state. He cares about Michigan deeply. He cares about bringing our jobs back, and he knows that I'm the best one to do that. And so now I'm out here trying to earn your support and your vote by communicating a message that proven leadership matters and results matter, and I'm excited for what the future holds.
You also have to get your base out to the polls. Now, John James is likely to get through the primary. We'll see. We'll see how Perry Johnson does. Jocelyn Benson is going to get through. But come November, who's going to go to the polls? Is it going to be the Democrats who go to the polls because they are so upset with Donald Trump that they want to keep him in check? And if the Democrats go to the polls to try and keep Donald Trump in check, does that help Jocelyn Benson in her run for governor? Or will Republicans get out there and say, oh, my gosh, we have got to make sure that Donald Trump still gets support. Otherwise, he'll be impeached and nothing will get done in the next couple of years. John James thinks Republicans will go to the polls, even though currently there are many polls out there that say the Republicans are not motivated.
Well, the Republican Party has always been called to stand up to injustice and tyranny. The Republican Party was founded to end slavery and hold this nation together. And now, today, Republicans in Michigan are being called to end socialism and hold our state together. Republicans have always and will always answer the call. And so with the bright leadership who understands the calling, answering it, and serving people around the state of Michigan, I have no doubt in my mind that Republicans will answer the call and save our state.
1-800-859-0957, 1-800-859-0WGR. Where are you at this point on the race for governor in Michigan? Let's go to John in Chesterfield. John, welcome to All Talk.
All right, good morning. All I want to say is that endorsements don't really mean anything to me, because the endorsements on both sides come from career politicians minus President Trump. So that don't carry no weight with me. Let's see what they do. And I got one thing about the affordability. John James mentioned it about federal taxes and all that stuff. The affordability issue is in our hands on Tuesday with all these millage requests and bond requests. If you're receiving federal funds, we're paying state taxes, and the money's coming back, especially to the schools, why would you be asking for more money? I would say vote no on these millage and bond requests until we figure out where the money's going. Let the federal government pay for it. All right, that's all I have.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it. Yeah, we're spending a lot of tax dollars to the federal government. That money is supposed to be coming back to Michigan. That's what our elected congressmen and senators are supposed to be doing, getting our fair share coming back in. If we're getting our fair share, should we be spending so much on these statewide and local funding efforts? Because those taxes are piled on top of the federal taxes. And at the end of the day, I think almost everybody feels like we're paying too much taxes. Let's go to Byron in Grosse Pointe Woods. Byron, welcome to All Talk.
Morning, Kevin. I heard your previous statement about how John James getting the endorsement of the president and all of his followers are going to get behind him. And I think you might be up for an upset on Tuesday night, because I know personally about 20 people that all voted for the president and are all behind Perry Johnson.
Yeah, I think this Perry Johnson run is really interesting. He has done very well. We had him on the show just the other day, and he says he is very confident. And he says out on the campaign trail, he is just getting tons of support, and he feels like these polls that have been out there are not accurate. And I really am interested to see what happens. I do not think this is a slam dunk for John James at all. I think this is going to be a lot closer than people think. And I'm really interested to see what happens. And I think this push down the stretch is going to be important. And who goes out and votes? Are Perry Johnson voters more motivated than John James voters right now in this primary? They might be. If they want Perry Johnson, they know they got to get out there and vote. If you're supporting John James, you might be like, oh, well, he's going to get in anyway. Maybe I don't need to vote in this primary. Not very many people vote in this primary. They really don't. A few thousand votes can make a big difference. Let's go to Todd in Sterling Heights. Todd, welcome to All Talk.
Hey, Kevin, thanks for having me on.
You bet.
Hey, I think John James and Perry Johnson should get on the ticket together. I think they would be unstoppable.
Which way would you put them? Who would be the governor and who would be the lieutenant governor?
Perry Johnson would be the governor, and John James would be the lieutenant governor.
Okay. All right. I don't know if John James would agree to be a lieutenant governor for Perry Johnson. I wouldn't be surprised if Perry Johnson would agree to be a lieutenant governor for John James, but they're both going to go for it. And, you know, once we have a clear winner here, that person could still go back and get the other person and put them on the ticket. What would that ticket look like to you? John James, Perry Johnson, or Perry Johnson, John James? That's interesting. That's something to think about. One listener says John James, he's proven he can win tough races and represent Michigan well. Another says Perry Johnson, we don't need another politician. We need someone who can actually run a business. That's pretty interesting. Someone in Livonia says, I'm voting for Benson. I think she's experienced and steady. We've had 8 years of Democrats running the state. Is another four a good idea? We'll see. It's all talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. It's all talk on a Thursday morning. I'm Kevin Dietz coming to you from the Golden Tower of the Fisher Building. The number is 1-800-859-0957, 1-800-859-0WJR. Pick up the phone. Give us a call. Give us a text. Be a part of the show. So Tuesday, voters in Michigan's 13th Congressional District are going to decide who will represent one of the state's most important districts in Washington. Democratic State Representative Donovan McKinney is asking voters to send him to Congress, saying it's time for a new generation of leadership focused on lowering costs, protecting health care, creating jobs, and investing in Detroit and Wayne County communities. He joins us now. Good morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Kevin. So glad and honored to be back on your show, brother.
Oh, I'm glad you're here. Boy, you got to be getting tired. Election day just a few days away. You can't rest now.
No, we can't. We're working our butts off every single day, brother. 5 days left.
five days, and then hopefully you get to continue on. What are you seeing out there? What are you hearing?
Yeah, so everywhere I go, it doesn't matter where, you know, people's race, where they live, you know, how they love, where they worship, like across the district, I'm hearing that people just want a change. What's happening is people aren't even surviving, let alone thriving in our communities. I know folks who are working 2-3 jobs, barely scraping by, not even making ends meet. I have seniors I've spoken with. All they get from Social Security every month is $900. Their rent has skyrocketed, as well as their utility bills. You know, because of the implementation of H.R. 1, the one big ugly bill, their food assistance, SNAP benefits just got cut by less than $30 a month. I don't know how you're supposed to survive off of that. You know, so they have to make these tough decisions, either paying out-of-pocket costs for, you know, their doctor's visits or paying for life-saving medicine, or paying for groceries, rent, utility bills. So these are across the board issues that our residents care about in the 13th district.
There's a new poll out that says 2/3 of Americans believe that the war in Iran is not worth the money. When I was driving into work today, there was a big sign up on I-75 that said, spend money on healthcare, not on wars. Can you hold the president accountable if you're elected?
Yes, so it takes a coalition. And so we need to get the majorities back in both the House and the Senate. But I'll tell you this, a majority means nothing unless you have the right people in that majority. And so you need people who are going to be focused on working families first. And that's what our campaign is all about. That is my commitment to this congressional district, because I don't know if you know this, Kevin, like the 13th congressional district here in Michigan, it's the fifth poorest district right in the entire country. And so, you know, what's top of mind, I keep talking about it, is people are stressing how in the hell they're going to pay their bills. And they can't even, I'm going to be honest with you, they are literally crying in my arms. Like I'm having these conversations. They're like, why isn't government working for me? And to your point of why we're spending millions of dollars in Iran, billions, I mean, I think on average it's $1 billion a day at least. And we're taking away resources from people right at home that justly deserve it. And I just, in good conscience, cannot support that. We have to bring resources back home. That has to be top of mind. And Democrats, we must follow suit in terms of being the party of the people. We have to follow through.
Well, there's a CNN poll out today that says 2/3 of voters believe President Trump is focusing on the wrong priorities. I bet that number's higher in the 13th district. How do you convince an administration from the opposite party to focus on the needs of the people in the 13th district?
Well, the opposite party, I've had conversations with Republicans, and I'm a state rep right now, and I'm in Lansing. I have conversations with other Republicans. I've even had conversations with Republicans and members of Congress right now. And a lot of them tell me they're having buyer's remorse of what's happening under the second Trump administration. But they tell us behind closed doors. But and I ask them, I'm like, won't you say it publicly? Like, step up and say it publicly, but they're afraid. And so, you know, at the end of the day, we need people in these positions of power and influence at the table who aren't afraid or who actually have courage. Courage to me doesn't necessarily mean the absence of being afraid. Courage to me means even when you are afraid, you still stand up and do the right thing on behalf of the people you represent. We have to put the working people of our communities and our districts first.
One way to fight out of poverty is education. Michigan is in a crisis. What are people saying about education in the 13th district and priorities there?
Yes, they want to be able to, they want good schools for their children, walkable communities, and amenities, right? And so what's happening is they're like, why isn't my children getting the skills necessary to thrive in this type of, you know, new technological world we're living in, right? So, you know, I don't know if you heard what happened at the GM Polton plant in our district right there. I think it was the first plant in America to be net zero right there on the border of Detroit and Hamtramck. But just a couple of months ago, they let go over 1,300 union jobs. They fired over 1,300 people, and they replaced them with just a few weeks later with robots. And so, you know, if we really want people to get this education, well, we need to steer them to what's happening with this new technology, whether it's, you know, AI or, you know, different ways to robotics, aerospace. Like, these are the things we have to prepare our children for. And that's what I'm seeing more than anything. People want to be able to work one job, not to make ends meet, but to literally have disposable income, benefits to take care of their family, and a retirement to look forward to. That is the American dream, and we have to go fight for that.
We're talking with Donovan McKinney, Democratic candidate for Michigan's 13th district. You're someone who's in touch with the people in your district. How important is it that we elect leaders who are in touch, who know the people in the district and understand what they're going through?
Yes, we need folks with the lived experience who are going to meet this moment with the urgency that it demands. Like I keep talking about, like, people need folks that are going to pick up the phone like it's a 5-alarm fire. What's happening with my opponent, the reason why I'm challenging him, because he has failed this district numerous occasions, and he has failed to pick up the phone for our constituents that need resources the most. And so what we're going to do on day one, we're going to restructure how the office allotment is distributed. We're going to literally open up multiple district offices so it can be available and accessible around the clock for people that need the help. But more importantly, we're going to fight like hell for you every single day and be your voice in D.C., just like I'm already doing in Lansing.
All right, we got about a minute left. Give us the website where people can learn more and give us your final pitch.
Yes, so DonovanForCongress.com. Follow me on all social media handles at Donovan McKinney. But we just put out a website called SharifFacts.com because there's a lot of money, tens of millions of dollars being spent against me from Sharif, APAC, Crypto, DT, ICE contractors, and they don't want a working class champion fighting for working class issues and people in our district. And so, you know, they're spreading a lot of these lies, a lot of misinformation. And so we are literally spreading a campaign that's full of love, that's full of, you know, real issues that people care about. And just let your viewers and listeners know we're going to fight like hell for them every single day.
All right. DonovanForCongress.com. Donovan McKinney, Democratic candidate, Michigan's 13th district. Good luck down the stretch. You can get some rest after Tuesday.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it, brother.
All right. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz.
Thanks for listening to All Talk with Kevin Dietz on 760 WJR and streaming on WJR.com, where Michigan comes to talk.
And welcome into the 10 o'clock hour of All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz, bringing you the latest headlines and the stories that everyone is talking about. Dr. Anthony Fauci, he repeatedly invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination during testimony before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, chaired by Senator Rand Paul. Paul, who has long accused Fauci of misleading the public about the COVID-19 pandemic, said the committee will vote next week on whether to hold Fauci in contempt of Congress. The hearing came despite a broad pardon previously issued to Fauci by former President Joe Biden, with some Republicans arguing additional legal questions remain unresolved. Over the weekend, Paul released more than 1,000 pages of Fauci's personal pandemic diary, claiming the writings differ from Fauci's public statements about the origins of COVID-19. Fauci's attorneys have rejected those allegations, calling them absolutely baseless and part of what they describe as Senator Paul's long-running political vendetta. This was Anthony Fauci.
Given Senator Paul's obvious obsession with calling for my prosecution, his repeated slanderous comments about me, and recently his publicly releasing my unredacted personal diary aimed at embarrassing and intimidating me, the only conclusion I can reach is that the sole reason he is calling me before this committee is to get me to say something, anything, that could vindicate his repeated public pledges that I end up, in his words, quote, behind bars.
This is how Rand Paul saw things.
President Biden issued you a sweeping pardon extending back to 2014, the same pardon he gave to his son, Hunter. A pardon may protect a person from criminal prosecution, doesn't rewrite history. It does not erase documents. It does not convert a misleading statement into a truthful one. And it does not prevent Congress from establishing what happened. There will be another pandemic. There will be another crisis. And there will again be officials who insist that uncertainty must be hidden for the public's own good. They will demand obedience. They will invoke science. I am the science, as though it were a commandment. They will argue that government officials cannot be questioned because questioning them would undermine public trust. They have it backwards. It is secrecy that destroys trust. It is arrogance that destroys trust. It is censorship that destroys trust. And it is the refusal to admit error that destroys trust. That loss of trust may be your most damaging legacy.
So with that, the questioning began, and this is pretty much what it sounded like all day. This is Josh Hawley and Dr. Fauci.
Well, nothing says honesty like taking the fifth, huh, Doc? Let's try something. What day of the week is it today?
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
What color tie are you wearing?
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
What color is the carpet in front of you?
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
Let's just get one thing straight. You don't have any rights under the Fifth Amendment because you've been pardoned, as you very well know. As the Supreme Court has been clear for a century and more, Brown versus Walker, 1896, when he has been pardoned, he may not stand upon his privilege.
And that's pretty much how the hearing went all day long. All right, let's talk with somebody who's not going to plead the fifth. Let's bring in Steve Courtney, WJR sports analyst, talking about this guy, Tarek Skubal.
It's out of the way.
3-2.
Swing and a miss. Strike three. It's 1,000 for Tarek Skubal.
Boom. First batter. Steve, what's going on?
Good morning, Kev. On the advice of counsel. Oh, yeah. How you doing there, my friend? Good morning, everyone. Yeah, everything was great at Comerica Park yesterday afternoon until it wasn't. You just heard the call. Didn't take long. The first hitter that Tarek Skubal saw, Taylor Ward, went for his signature changeup, whiffed. Indeed, strikeout number 1,000 for Tarek Skubal. For the record, Kev, Tarek becomes the 17th pitcher in franchise history to reach 1,000 strikeouts and just the fourth lefty to do so. He was the quickest to do it by nearly 100 innings, taking 857 innings to accomplish it compared to the 944 and two-thirds, as was done by Max Scherzer. So, Tarek gets the start yesterday. Trade rumors are swirling. That is going to continue. But what we saw at the ballpark, Kev, was the epitome of how this Tigers season has gone. As a matter of fact, Tarek Skubal one out away from walking off the hill with seven scoreless innings, but his day ends on a two-out RBI single by Leody Taveras. The bullpen comes in, starting with Kyle Finnegan, and I'm just going to put my cards on the table. The Tigers' bullpen is absolute garbage. So the bottom line here, the Orioles in the finale get a 10-9 win, rallying from the 7-run deficit. Okay, here's what you need to know. Major League Baseball's trade deadline is Monday, August 3rd, 6 o'clock. According to Jeff Passan, who covers baseball very, very well for ESPN, basically what it comes down to as far as teams interested in Tarek Skubal, you've got the Milwaukee Brewers, who, according to reports, Kev, putting on quite a push. The favorites, of course, remain the Los Angeles Dodgers. So is it only a matter of time? I think the result of yesterday kind of solidified the whole deal as far as the mindset of Scott Harris and probably A.J. Hinch as well, that you got to move Tarek Skubal. You don't leave your money on the poker table, do you? And there's a lot of things at work here because of the potential labor stoppage come fall when the current collective bargaining agreement comes to an end. Again, a little refresher. The owners want to implement salary cap. The players, the union, saying, yeah, that's not going to happen. So, Kev, we'll have to wait and see. I just don't think it's going to take too much longer for this trade to go on.
All right, so we have a garbage bullpen, and we're going to get rid of the best starter in all of baseball. What does that mean for fans this year?
Well, I mean, you've got to get while the getting's good, because if you keep Skubal, and look, at the way the Tigers are playing right now, there's absolutely no guarantee they're going to make the postseason to begin with. So if you hang on to Tarek Skubal, you come out of it with absolutely nothing. As an organization, you just can't afford to do
that. That's bad business. All right, WJR Sports Analyst Steve Courtney, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Enjoy, Kev.
It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. It's All Talk on a Thursday morning. I'm Kevin Dietz coming to you from the Golden Tower of the Fisher Building. The number is 1-800-859-0957, 1-800-859-0WJR. Pick up the phone. Send us a text. Be a part of the show. Federal Reserve, they've decided to leave interest rates unchanged for now, despite pressure from President Trump to lower borrowing costs. The Fed's benchmark rate remains at between 3.5 and 3.75, and the decision wasn't unanimous, which was interesting. Three voting members actually favored raising rates because inflation remains above the Fed's 2% target. Fed Chair Kevin Warsh says the central bank remains focused on bringing inflation under control, but admits there are no magic wands to make that happen. Let's bring in Chris Alberta, President and CEO of Principium Tactical Wealth Management. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Hey, Kevin. Glad to be here.
Yeah, right? Probably no surprises here.
No, I mean, no surprises. I don't even know if there was anticipation of a surprise, a little dissension in the ranks. I mean, I don't know how rare that is. Sometimes there's probably discussion and some argumentation that perhaps doesn't make the press or they're not as vocal about it. But, I mean, there's no real surprise at all. It's going to kind of stay as it is, and it would have been good for it to go up in some ways and good for it to go down in some ways. It depends on what kind of side of the economic aisle you land on.
Yeah, for most people, the news comes out like this, and it makes them think about mortgage rates and are my kids ever going to move out of my basement? And you know, right? So in times like this, you're looking at this and you're seeing that. Well, three of these people thought maybe interest rates should have gone up. Am I in for the long haul? Can you even? Is it even worth trying to sort of time interest rates to buying a house, or do you just when it's time to get into a house, do you just get into a house?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that on the whole, the market tends to respond like a teeter-totter a little bit. So on one hand, if there's a lot of inventory because things aren't selling as much, then prices tend to drop. That price drop, you know, probably offsets the little bit higher rate you'd spend on a mortgage. I mean, if you tell a client of mine in their 70s right now that my kids are squeamish over buying a house at 6.5%, they laugh their butts off because they paid 13% 30 years ago, and right, that was kind of the norm. So in part, there's some recency bias because people got used to mortgages in the 3s and 4s, and that was a very short time frame, what's called quantitative easing, and things were really suppressed rate-wise. Another interesting thing, and I'm not a mortgage expert, but you have to remember, too, that mortgage rates are really kind of forward-facing, forward-looking thing. They're not really dependent at all directly on what the Fed is doing with what's called the overnight rate, which is what we're really talking about here. but they are highly dependent on bond rates. And when the rates at the 10-year Treasury specifically are higher, bond values tend to suffer. So that's why, in many cases, you know, without some alleviation to the bond market, the mortgage rate kind of stay where they are. Now, they're not obnoxiously high, but they're not what they were a few years ago. So you can see both sides of that equation. It's still an okay time to buy a house. There's just not a lot of inventory relative to the money supply.
Yeah, it's sort of a mood that these interest rate and Fed meetings put consumers in, I think. I think about a car, you know, my mileage is getting up there, and I wonder about when am I going to get a new car. And a new car costs about as much as a house did when I bought my house. So you tend to think about those things a little longer. Do people, if they feel like interest rates aren't coming down soon, do they stay in their car longer? Do they, if they're going to buy a new car, do they buy less of a car, or do they just move forward and say, hey, that's what the interest rate was when I bought?
Yeah, I mean, perhaps. And that's why you see also, you know, the lenders are, I wouldn't say sneaky is probably the wrong word. The lenders have been very creative because people are, frankly, less interest rate obsessed than they are monthly payment obsessed. So if you tell the dealership, you know, you're really trying to stay at $500 a month, I mean, before you know it, they can stretch that term out to 84 months, where 60 months used to be the norm. So you're spending more on a car than we ever have before at a rate perhaps that's higher than you'd like. But if you can make that payment digestible, then you end up buying the car anyway, which is in many cases why there's so many people with tremendous amounts of negative equity on their car. They owe far more, you know, than it's worth. But look, the other side of this equation, too, is that an interest rate environment that has been higher in the 10-year and the 30-year has been good for people's pension payouts. It's been good for annuity rates at insurance companies. I mean, there's a whole cascade of things that have been very, very pleasant from my end working with clients that we didn't have 5 years ago as a result of the Treasury being pretty good, the Fed rate being pretty good. So, you know, there's a pro and a con to all of these things. And Trump, of course, wants it lowered because that will stimulate economics and spending, and that'll make the economy look good. And he's very concerned about that. You can't blame him. But, you know, there is a pro and a con and a black and a white to all these things, depending on where you're at in the lending, purchasing, investing cycle.
Yeah, no, that's a good point and very, very true. I think I worry about, you talking about more spending out there. I'm worried about people with credit card debt. It seems like the numbers just keep going up and up, record numbers of credit card debt. We talk about affordability and people not being able to make their bills. With the, you know, with the rates where they are and the credit card rates where they are, what do you tell people, you know, facing heavy credit card debt? What do you recommend?
Well, listen, I don't, you know, I'm primarily in the retiree market. So most people that I'm working with, they've accumulated a fair sum of money and they've been rather good conservative savers and spenders, modest spenders in many cases. But when you deal with younger people, especially, you really do have to encourage them, like, hey, don't spend what you don't actually have. I mean, the old school mentality of having a few months, you know, worth of bill pay in a reserve account, that kind of thing, it's kind of gone wayward. And not to warp you on this, but if really the most dangerous thing that the younger consumers are facing today is the idea of things like Affirm and Klarna and others. I mean, when you are financing a pizza that's $15 and paying it off over 24 months, something is really, really wrong with the world. And that kind of lending at that 25 and 30% is totally unregulated, not like credit cards. And it's something really that our legislative body should be tackling, because young people who are doing the simplest little things like a trip to Cedar Point and they're going to pay it off 3 years from now, there's got to be a limit to that before you find yourself in so much trouble you can't dig out.
Right. So the market didn't love the news. The Dow fell, I think, more than 1,100 points. Does your phone ring when that happens? What do you tell investors, I mean, not to do?
Well, yesterday, you know, the last few days have been pretty busy. Last week, this is a bigger conversation, too. There's a lot of deleveraging going on in the marketplace, especially around the tech and the AI stocks. And that's a much more complex conversation. But there has been some overpricing and overbloating on some of those that now internally are getting what they refer to as deleveraged. And those positions have sank a ton. I mean, you see positions that were up 40, 50% year to date that are back down to 10, 12. That's not indicative of the S&P 500 or the Dow. But certainly there's a lot of those bigger stocks that have been massively affected by this kind of pullback. It's still healthy, Gav. It's still way up relative to expectations, but it's not what it was a month ago.
Yeah, my friends are, the term they're using is taking a beating on tech and AI this week.
There is a lashing. Beating is not even enough of a word.
Well, that happens. Are you bullish on holding this stuff for the long term? It seems like AI is where all the billionaires are going.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I always tell everybody around me, anybody who says they know what's going to happen in the market tomorrow is full of baloney. No one knows what's going to happen tomorrow. But at least in the short term, that kind of 18 to 24 month time frame, there's nothing that's going to stop the momentum of the locomotive that is AI. And that doesn't mean there won't be jagged edges. I mean, if you're complaining about having been up 75% and now you're back down to 41%, you're complaining about the wrong thing. But I mean, that's really indicative of almost all of the broad market positions over the last few years. There's been really big peaks, but there's been some valleys along the way from, you know, to Liberation Day to starts of wars. And it's interesting to see how much Wall Street has started to, frankly, ignore what's happening in D.C. because, the train keeps moving regardless of who says what.
Yeah, it's bouncing off the walls. Chris Alberta, President and CEO of Principium Tactical Wealth Management. Appreciate the expertise and the conversation. All right, quick break. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. Yeah, the primary, it is this Tuesday. Coming up on Tuesday, voters of Michigan's 7th Congressional District will head to the polls to choose their next representative in Washington for the primary. Democratic candidate William Lawrence says he's running to bring fresh leadership focused on lowering costs, protecting health care, strengthening public education, and creating economic opportunity across mid-Michigan. Let's welcome William Lawrence, Democratic candidate for Michigan's 7th District. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, we're down to the stretch. What are you telling independent voters, people who haven't decided yet? What's the message to them?
Well, I'm bought by the corporate money, and I'm independent of the D.C. insiders. I'm a local guy. I was raised in East Lansing. I live in the Lansing area, spent my whole life in mid-Michigan, and I'm working hard to stop these AI data centers that are pushing in on our small towns, stop these stupid wars around the world that are diminishing our standing and wasting our money, and bring that money home to invest in housing and health care that the American people can count on.
Let's talk about data centers for a minute. It has really become a hot topic. What are people's concerns, and what are you telling them about solutions?
Well, you know, I have showed up and started hearing from voters in these, you know, township board meetings, fighting in Lyon Township, in Howell Township, in Mason, and in Lansing. And, you know, there's a lot of concerns. It's about the energy bills. It's about the home values. It's about the noise pollution, the light pollution, the water. But really, it's about who decides. You know, you got these billionaires from Silicon Valley who are coming in and signing the local township officials to non-disclosure agreements, so they can't even talk about the deals. And then they want to come forward and tell everybody, just trust us, this is a great deal. Why would anybody trust? And oh, by the way, DTE and Consumers Energy have assured us that your rates won't rise. People don't believe that. Who trusts DTE and consumers? Why should we trust these billionaires from Silicon Valley? So that is really what I think is rubbing people the wrong way, is the sense that there's no democracy in this. There's no self-determination in this. And then you've got really rich people coming in and trying to lecture to us about what's best.
Well, do we need guardrails for data centers, or do we need a moratorium?
Well, I believe we need a moratorium so that we can put appropriate regulations in place. I mean, you hear some other candidates talk about how, you know, this should just be a matter of local control and everybody should put their own regulations in place. But we saw what happened in Saline Township, where the people said no, the township board actually said no and denied the permit, but then OpenAI and Oracle came in and they said, well, we have $1 trillion and you don't, so we're going to sue you into oblivion. And the township couldn't stand up against that in court, so they settled. That's what local control amounts to in this environment. So we need to put a pause on this at the federal level. No township or city should have to fight this battle on their own. And then we can have a conversation across the whole district and across the whole country about, you know, if we're going to do this, how do we do it in the right way and ensure that everybody benefits and nobody is sacrificed?
You mentioned the high cost of the war. Two-thirds of voters in a new poll say the war has not been worth the cost. The president disagrees. How do you convince the president to change course?
Well, he started this war with no strategy, no plan. let's be honest, he did an operation in Venezuela that was successful to remove Maduro, and he got high on his own supply. And he had some hawkish advisors who have been jonesing for a war with Iran for decades, and they convinced him it was going to go down the same way in Tehran. Turns out that Iran is a very different, can of worms than Venezuela is. And the fact of the matter is that we're getting clobbered in the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when, gas was under $3. It was about 6 months ago. And now I just drove by and, I filled up yesterday for $4.45 a gallon. And that's because we're in worse shape today than we were before the war began. The president and his advisors need to face the music, realize they messed up, and come to the table to get the strait back open so we can get the cost of gas and groceries down and start to recover our global standing, which has been catastrophically damaged.
You say if elected, you can help create economic opportunity across mid-Michigan. How would you do that?
Well, we got to invest in the basics that every one of us depend on. That starts with housing. We all need a roof over their head. I have a track record of fighting for affordable housing and preventing unjust evictions here in mid-Michigan. I've won on that. There's a lot more to win and fight for on that. And I believe that we all need health care that covers us for life. I mean, I spoke with a woman who lost her health care coverage because her husband died. She was trying to make arrangements for his funeral while also figuring out how she was going to pay for her insurance. That is inhumane. Nobody should have to go through that in the richest country in the world. That's why I support a single-payer health care plan like Medicare for All. And then we need to invest in our education, because our K-12 and our public education is what actually made America great. The opportunity for anybody to get a quality education and pursue their passion and get a good-paying job, that has been under attack from people like Betsy DeVos and these billionaires who want to privatize and diminish our education because they know that uneducated people are easier to take advantage of. So we need to get back to basics in education, housing, and healthcare, and protect Social Security is the last one I'd mention, because that is a foundation of our social compact in the country. We passed that under the New Deal, and we need to protect it now because people would like to take it away, and that would be disastrous for our seniors and for all of us.
Sounds great. It also sounds expensive. Do we need to worry about spending? Do we need to worry about the deficit, or is it just changing priorities?
Well, it's changing priorities in part. Certainly, I think, this military budget, which has now exceeded $1 trillion, is out of control, and we can cut that budget significantly without cutting a single service member's pay, job, or benefits, or having any cuts to the VA whatsoever. We can protect all of that while also reallocating resources to invest in the other stuff we need. But the other fact of the matter is we now have our world's first trillionaire, Elon Musk. We've got these billionaires who are super wealthy and are not paying their fair share. Like on Social Security, for instance, they pay a small fraction of what you and I pay on each paycheck because there is a cap on the amount of income that can be taxed to pay the Social Security fund. I think that the wealthiest people in the country, these billionaires, should pay the same portion on each paycheck that you and I pay, because that's what it means to live in a society. We all benefit, but we also all depend on each other, and we all have to pay our due.
What's the website? How can we find out more about your campaign?
WeWill2026.com. WeWill2026.com, because we're working hard to serve the community. We believe we will win on August 4th in this primary, and we will beat Tom Barrett on November 3rd so we can have some unbought, independent-minded representation in Washington, D.C.
All right, William Lawrence, Democratic candidate for Michigan's 7th District. Thanks for checking in. Good luck down the stretch.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you. Have a good one.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. It's All Talk on a Thursday morning. I'm Kevin Dietz coming to you from the Golden Tower of the Fisher Building. The number is 1-800-859-0957, 1-800-859-0WJR. Give us a call. Give us a text. We're going to take your calls coming up at 11:35. This is a shocking story. It really is. A newly released independent investigation into the Interlochen Center for the Arts paints a disturbing picture spanning decades. The 97-page report says approximately 70 former students reported being sexually abused or exploited by nearly 50 adults in leadership positions over several decades. This is Interlochen. It's up in northern Michigan. Investigators concluded that the abuse ranged from inappropriate comments and grooming to rape, And they found allegations that some leaders either failed to recognize warning signs, looked the other way, or inadequately responded to reports of misconduct. Let's bring in Dave Boucher. He is the investigative reporter with the Detroit Free Press who's been following this story. Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm okay. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you being here. There's a lot to get into here. I mean, the numbers are shocking. Nearly 50 adults in leadership positions over several decades. Who did the report? Why did they do it? And what is law enforcement position at this point?
Sure. So according to Interlochen, they, administrators at the school, received a report in 2024 from a former student who made an allegation of abuse against a longtime employee, faculty, staff member there at the school. And they say, Interlochen says that prompted them to hire an outside law firm, a Massachusetts-based law firm, to kind of start this investigation. And then the scope of the investigation kind of ballooned from there. Initially started at looking at allegations of abuse decades ago, 60s and 70s. Then it eventually expanded to looking at any allegation of abuse since the 60s and 70s. And ultimately, it also expanded to include the possibility of abuse by Jeffrey Epstein, the notorious sex offender who both attended the camp and then later became a longtime donor and benefactor of the camp.
And so in doing this, they start talking to people, and you know, one interview leads to another interview leads to another interview. What role do we think Jeffrey Epstein had in any of this? Is he a funder of Interlochen?
Yeah, he was. He donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to the campus. At one point, there was a facility that was named after him. The Interlochen ultimately changed the name in 2009 after his first criminal conviction. And then last month, even with the name change, they tore down the whole building. They just destroyed the building there on campus. So, but he was connected to the school for more than a decade. And there were two allegations from a couple of students who said that they met him through this campus and through his connection to the campus. And one of them says that he offered to help pay the tuition. This is not a inexpensive, you know, academy and center there. And that the student ultimately, Epstein ultimately stopped paying that when the student didn't agree to do what Epstein wanted them to do. So he is in the report, but he is one of 47, as you noted, adults spanning all sorts of roles and decades who are accused of preying on these kids in this remote camp.
So are they indicating that these adults were perhaps covering up for each other or were working together? It doesn't sound like this would just be by chance.
No, I think what was something that we really noted is for many of the kids, this is the camp largely for kids who are under 18 years old. For many of the kids at the camp and the academy, they're staying in dorms where there's essentially like a residence life staff member. So an adult who is there at the dorm. And in order for many of these adults to interact with these students, they had to sign them out of these dorms. So there was a staff member who was there, again, who's an adult, who had to see this teacher sign out a student to leave to, according to the students, go out to dinner, go to the professor's home, go out into the woods, you know, go out and do these things. And they're doing it past the curfew for this campus. They're doing it late at night, and then they're signing the student back in late at night. Students point to that and other evidence to indicate that adults and staffers there must have known that something was going on and that there's no reasonable expectation that adults should routinely sign kids out past curfew and take them out anywhere at night. You know, there's also the nature of this campus. This is a campus that largely focuses on the performing arts, so music, dance, singing, that sort of thing. So it's a place where a prodigy, both either a teacher or a student, could have lots of one-on-one time. There was lots of one-on-one time for lessons or for practice or for performances off campus. And so some of the other students who spoke with investigators indicated that also kind of led to some of the alleged abuse.
Yeah, inappropriate comments, one thing, grooming, rape, another. Law enforcement has said that they don't have enough information to really open up a full investigation yet. They're saying they need these witnesses to come forward to them. Working off of this report isn't enough. They're saying a lot of it was redacted, and they would need this information to be unredacted. Do you think it's likely that there will be some law enforcement investigation? There's no statute of limitations when it comes to sex crimes.
So I think that people are reviewing the statute of limitations. This is something we're looking at too. And this is not just unique to Interlochen, right? Like the statute of limitations, both related to criminal charges and to civil liability. This has come up in the context of Larry Nassar, who had connections at Michigan State University as well. And so this is something that I know that people are looking at. I will say that Interlochen reported providing the report itself to both the Grand Traverse County Prosecutor's Office and to the Sheriff's Office. They told us, Interlochen told us, that they gave the names of the accused to the Prosecutor's Office. I will tell you that typically the law enforcement agency, in this case the Sheriff's Office, would do the investigating related to the names and then bring any possible charges that would stem that investigation to the prosecutor. So I know that, like you said, law enforcement is reviewing these reports, and I think it will be interesting to see whether or not they ultimately decide they can or they can't do anything. I think it's critical to note as well, Interlochen and the private law firm approached, to some degree, all 47 of the former staff members who were accused in this report. Now, many of the staff of these people are dead. Some of them died a long time ago. But they approached all of them. They heard and communicated with four of them, but they approached all the people accused. And so that's something that we're looking at as well, and whether or not that might have an impact on any sort of criminal investigation or civil liability investigation that could come out.
What is Interlochen saying?
Sure. So Interlochen is, first and foremost, apologizing. They've apologized to the students. They've apologized to anybody who, you know, could be traumatized or had to endure what they say happened at the camp. They've also noted that the vast majority of the allegations stem from conduct before the year 2000, and that none of the 47 people accused in this report continue to work at the facility, at the campus. They've also pushed to change the names of scholarships, buildings, other institutions around campus that might bear the names of some of the people who are tied to this report. They told us moments after we published our story this week that they removed the name of a former trustee from a building who was accused by two people of pretty graphic sexual abuse. So they're also offering counseling for people who want to sign up, and they're offering to create virtual community space for students who want to connect. But, you know, the investigators found, and lawyers for the investigators are telling us and others, that the students want to see accountability. What accountability ultimately looks like still remains to be seen, and everybody, of course, has their own definition for what might meet accountability in this context. But this is certainly not the end of what happened, and you know what these students reported happened for decades at the campus.
Dave Boucher, investigative reporter with the Detroit Free Press. You can read his story at freep.com. Excellent work. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. Welcome into the 11 o'clock hour of All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz, coming to you from the Golden Tower of the Fisher Building, bringing you the latest headlines and the stories everyone is talking about. President Trump says the United States is prepared to intensify military action against Iran after another missile attack targeting U.S. forces in Jordan was intercepted without casualties. Reports indicate military leaders have presented Trump with options ranging from continued retaliatory strikes to broader air campaign targeting Iran's missile capabilities. The administration is also considering additional sanctions tied to Iran while urging Congress to include new tariffs in pending Russia sanctions legislation. U.S. officials continue to monitor concerns about a widening regional conflict after Saudi Arabia joined recent military operations. The Pentagon says protecting American troops and deterring future attacks remain the top priorities. The father of convicted Appalachian high school shooter Colt Gray is scheduled to be sentenced after being found guilty on 27 criminal counts. Prosecutors argued Colin Gray ignored warning signs about his son's mental health and provided him with the rifle used in the attack. The shooting killed two students and two teachers while injuring 11 others. Colt Gray has already pleaded guilty and is serving life in prison without parole. Prosecutors say the father's actions directly contributed to one of Georgia's deadliest shootings. Investors are awaiting a new inflation report after the Federal Reserve voted to leave interest rates unchanged for a fifth consecutive meeting. Economists expect the Fed's preferred inflation gauge to show prices rose 3.8% in June, down slightly from May, but still above the central bank's target. Fed Chair Kevin Warr says inflation remains stubborn and warned it will take time to bring prices under control.
Today, as you know, our committee decided to vote by a 9-3 vote to maintain the target range for the federal funds rate at 3.5% to 3.75%. The committee is continuing its policy of making ample reserves in the banking system. The economy is showing impressive resilience. Even with recent shocks, the trends are positive and reveal solid growth. Job gains have kept pace with the workforce, and the unemployment rate has changed little. Inflation remains elevated relative to the committee's 2% goal. The committee remains resolute. You've heard this before, but we will deliver price stability.
Three Federal Reserve officials favored raising rates, marking the largest number of dissents supporting the same move in nearly a decade. President Trump says he'd like to see lower interest rates, but acknowledged most Fed officials disagree. Which states are at the top of the list for best places to live in America? A new national scorecard is giving Michigan some tough marks. Marie Osborne's here with that.
Yeah, this hurts a little bit, but here we go. U.S. News has released its 2026 Best States Rankings, measuring all 50 states across key quality of life indicators, including education, healthcare, the economy, infrastructure, public safety, and more. Michigan landed near the bottom of the list, placing 46th overall, ahead only of New Mexico, Mississippi, Alaska, and Louisiana. Arkansas rounded out the bottom tier. The state's strongest showing came in healthcare, where it ranked 24th nationally, but lower placements in education, the economy, and infrastructure weighed pretty heavily on the overall score. Michigan finished 45th in education, 43rd in the economy, 42nd in infrastructure. At the top of the rankings, we have Utah. They claim the number one spot, followed by South Dakota, Minnesota, North Dakota, and Nebraska. The rankings, Kevin, are based on 71 different measures and also incorporated public opinion surveys from more than 56,000 Americans collected over several years.
Utah, that sounds pretty nice out there. I don't know. What amazes me, Marie, is so 46, and I know it's just a survey, but we talk about education being 44th and fourth grade reading and all this stuff. And yet it seems like the popularity of Governor Gretchen Whitmer is still, I think it's over 80% of people have a favorable opinion, and these numbers come in, and I don't really understand it.
And we see these numbers over and over and over again. You know, obviously, I mean, some people will blame this on Governor Whitmer. This certainly doesn't look good for her. She's been in office 8 years. But the fact is, this goes back for a while. We've had the issue with education for a while. Being 45th in education, and I mean, look at the company we're keeping here with Mississippi and New Mexico, places that we know have struggled in these areas in the past. It's really dire.
Yeah, Mississippi may shoot past us by a large amount now that they got their reading in check. They went from nearly worst to first. And I just hope that we're paying attention to some of these states where people want to live so that we can emulate some of those things and do some of the things that they're doing.
Right. And, you know, and people will say, oh, well, of course, everybody wants to live where there's a lot of sunshine. Well, we have Minnesota, North Dakota, and Nebraska in this top five list.
Yeah.
So it is not just based on that. It is based on other things and things that I think we need to be paying attention to.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing us
that.
That's really, really eye-opening. Thanks. Yeah, there's moments in sports when you realize you're watching more than a game. You're watching a chapter possibly close. That may have been the case yesterday afternoon at Comerica Park. Tarek Skubal walked to the mound with trade rumors surrounding him, knowing he needed just one strikeout to reach an incredible milestone, 1,000 career strikeouts. It took him exactly one batter to get his strikeout.
Out of the way. 3-2.
Swing and a miss. Strike three. It's 1,000 for Tarek Skubal.
Very cool moment for Tarek Skubal. He tipped his cap to the crowd and received the kind of ovation you would expect of Detroiters, thanking him, thinking he's great. The city absolutely loves Tarek Skubal. But here's the dilemma facing Tigers president Scott Harris. If another organization is willing to give you a package of elite young prospects, you probably have to listen. That's the business side of it. It can be cold and calculated, but sometimes it's the right move. Baseball isn't just played on spreadsheets. Fans don't buy tickets to watch prospects who might someday become stars. They buy tickets to watch stars like Tarek Skubal, who's already that guy. He's developed into one of the premier pitchers in Major League Baseball. Those players don't come around very often. When you have one, you better be pretty certain that you're going to get something extraordinary in return before you let them just walk out the door. Skubal, he battled through seven innings, reaching a career milestone, walked off to a standing ovation, and then watched another crazy late lead disappear. The Tigers lost yesterday. They were up 7-0 when Skubal left. They lost 10-9 in 12 innings. It was a painful reminder of the season that they have had. Flashes of brilliance, followed by frustration. After the game, Skubal didn't sound angry. He didn't sound bitter. He just sounded tired. Tired of answering questions about where he'll be in a week instead of talking about the game he just pitched. He said, right now, I'm a Detroit Tiger. That's all I know. We'll see. The trade deadline is Monday at 6 p.m. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz coming to you from the Golden Tower of the Fisher Building. The number is 1-800-859-0957, 1-800-859-0WJR. We're going to take your calls and read your texts coming up at 11:35. So pick up the phone and be a part of the show. A new Gallup poll shows confidence in one of America's most respected institutions has fallen to an all-time low. Just 33% of Americans now approve of the Supreme Court, down from last year's previous record low. At the same time, President Trump's approval rating sits at 34%, and Congress fares even worse, with just 13.5% of Americans approving its performance. The numbers raise a question. Is this about dissatisfaction with individual leaders, or have Americans lost confidence in the country's institutions themselves? Also out, a poll saying two-thirds of voters say Donald Trump is focusing on the wrong priorities. I believe that was a CNN poll. Another poll I saw said two-thirds of Americans think the war in Iran is not worth the money. I think anybody who's answered a poll is not terribly happy or confident in where we're going and who's leading the lead, driving the train. Let's bring in Dennis Darnoy, founder of Densar Consulting. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Kevin. How are you? And yes, it seems like everyone's kind of grumpy if they're answering polls.
Yeah, it seems like these polls were done in February when it was freezing cold and everybody was angry. What do you think? Is this just the way polls go, or is something going on?
No, I do think, you know, in all seriousness, there is a general dissatisfaction where the country's going. And then when you bear down on specific institutions, whether it's the Supreme Court, whether it's Congress or the president's performance, you then see, you know, how far it's dropped. I mean, the fascinating thing about the Supreme Court's job approval rating was it dropped the most among Republicans. You know, yet this is a court that is, you know, 6-3 conservative. The number of Trump appointees outnumbers. You know, the number of progressive justices and more than Biden had. And yet, you know, Republicans, you know, had probably, I think it was last year was around 79% approval. You know, now it's down to 58%. You know, so again, it's interesting that, you know, for as conservative a court that we have, Republicans have soured very much on them.
Yeah, I assume everything is about 50% as good as you can get on any kind of poll these days. It seems like everybody is so divided and so dug in. But I would have guessed, I don't know, if we went back, I don't know, 15 or 20 years, I would think like the Supreme Court would probably have like a 80% approval rating or some very high number. 33 seems very, very low.
Oh, it is incredibly low. And back in 2000, as you said, it was more along the lines in the 70s. I think it was high 60s that they, you know, where their approval rating was. But what you've seen is, you know, when you had a court come out, you know, the Roberts court come out and overturn Roe v. Wade, you saw some, obviously, Democrats very disappointed with that decision. Then you've seen Republicans recently feel as if the Supreme Court has, you know, ruled against some of the things that Donald Trump wanted to get accomplished. So, you know, now Republicans are souring on the court. So I think, you know, as we have this this very partisan and political lens that we're viewing things through. When decisions don't go your way, especially at the court, partisans are going to look at it and again have disapproval. But before, I think the court was seen less as a political instrument. Again, you could disagree with their arguments or their decisions, but a lot of times they would water down precedent. And I think what we've seen lately is the Supreme Court willing to just overhaul precedent and come up with sort of different definitions. And, you know, Americans don't like the fact that on one day the law said this and then the next day, you know, according to the court, the law says that. So it's not surprising to see that it's dropped. But the depth is pretty scary, actually.
I would think that social media has a lot to do with the numbers being so low. Now it's so easy to bash on everybody and anybody. Bashing on justices on social media is way more prevalent than you might expect it to just come across on the nightly news.
Well, certainly. I mean, so you take, for example, there were a couple of speeches that Justice Thomas gave and which were supported and funded by a conservative organization, a conservative donor. I can tell you that, I actually worked at the court from 1991 through 1995. And justices during that time gave speeches and they were, supported by benefactors on both sides. But there was no social media to impugn or to attack the justice or to, guess at what his or her motivation might have been. So now that, you can have anyone out there, come up with some crackpot theory, put it in a group and then the people like it and send it around. It definitely makes all of elected official life, whether, again, Supreme Court justices, state legislators, congressional leaders, it makes life a whole lot difficult because there are people willing to, in a moment's notice, make a comment on something that they generally don't have any background on.
You look at Congress, 13.5% approval rating. It makes you wonder who those 13.5% people are that are approving of them. Now, that's a terrible number. I don't know. I mean, I feel like these people are getting elected. They go and they try and get stuff done. Maybe they don't get anything done, but 13.5 is abysmal.
Yeah, the funny thing about that number is when you ask it generally, do you approve of how Congress is doing their job? Most people come out and say no. When you ask how is your congressperson performing their duties, then the numbers actually increase and people are much more pleased with their independent, with their own congressperson or senator. So I think it's just one of those things where there's this, collective feel that Congress doesn't do anything, we're constant shutdowns, this, that, and the other thing, and so forth. So far, then the general feeling for Congress is a negative one. But if you ask about your individual representative, they end up getting higher marks than 13%.
It's the rest of those bums. It's not our person. It's the rest of those
exactly.
bums. What do you think of two-thirds of people thinking the war in Iran is not worth the money? Will that have an impact on this election, do you think?
Oh, it definitely will be part of the midterms, which are just right, coming up around the corner, because the affordability is still going to be the number one topic among Democrats. And they're going to sit there and say, look at your energy bills, look at your gas bills, look at your food bills. And yet look at all this money that we're spending on a war. And then, unfortunately, they will, look at some of the president's remarks about saying, I'm not going to get ourselves into another foreign war or, a never ending war. And right now, there just doesn't seem to be any immediate end to the conflict in Iran. So again, I think that it is going to be something that we're going to hear Democrat and progressive candidates lob at Republicans over and over again throughout, from August through November.
Are Republicans who are running speaking out against the war spending at all, or are they too afraid to say anything bad about Donald Trump out of losing his support because he's on a run here with the people he's backing in the primaries?
Yeah, so there's a very small handful of House Republicans who have tried to call for an end to the war. They've tried to call for a little bit more of a what is our end goal? And so there's a little bit of pushback, but generally speaking, no. As until we get through the primaries, You're not going to see a lot of Republican pushback. Again, there is, you know, things that go on sort of behind the scenes, and there's starting to be a little bit of displeasure with the Secretary of Defense or Secretary of War, or whatever you want to call him, you know, in terms of, you know, how the money's being spent, and then constantly coming back to Congress and asking for more money. You're seeing Republicans on the Senate side start to push back on that, as they have concerns that the war in Iran is going to, you know, impact the midterms. So there are small little pockets of, mm-hmm. of resistance, but not a large general one yet.
Dennis Darnoy, founder of Densar Consulting. Thanks for the conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Kevin. Have a good one.
All right. Your calls are next. 1-800-859-0WJR. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. And it is 11:37. That means it is your turn to talk. 1-800-859-0957. 1-800-859-0WJR. Give us a call. Give us a text. Be a part of the show. So are you team Dr. Fauci or are you team Rand Paul? Did Dr. Fauci mislead us? Or did he do the best he could with the information he had? Are Republicans out to get Dr. Fauci personally, or are they out to get the truth to avoid mistakes when the next pandemic arrives? This was Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Given Senator Paul's obvious obsession with calling for my prosecution, his repeated slanderous comments about me, and recently his publicly releasing my unredacted personal diary aimed at embarrassing and intimidating me, the only conclusion I can reach is that the sole reason he is calling me before this committee is to get me to say something, anything, that could vindicate his repeated public pledges that I end up, in his words, quote, behind bars.
Does that sound right to you, or does what Rand Paul is saying sound right to you?
President Biden issued you a sweeping pardon extending back to 2014, the same pardon he gave to his son Hunter. A pardon may protect a person from criminal prosecution, doesn't rewrite history. It does not erase documents. It does not convert a misleading statement into a truthful one. And it does not prevent Congress from establishing what happened. There will be another pandemic. There will be another crisis. And there will again be officials who insist that uncertainty must be hidden for the public's own good. They will demand obedience. They will invoke science. I am the science, as though it were a commandment. They will argue that government officials cannot be questioned because questioning them would undermine public trust. They have it backwards. It is secrecy that destroys trust. It is arrogance that destroys trust. It is censorship that destroys trust. And it is the refusal to admit error that destroys trust. That loss of trust may be your most damaging legacy.
Well, those two guys don't trust each other, so this is how the hearing went.
Well, nothing says honesty like taking the fifth, huh, Doc? Let's try something. What day of the week is it today?
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
What color tie are you wearing?
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
What color is the carpet in front of you?
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer based upon my rights under the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution.
Let's just get one thing straight. You don't have any rights under the Fifth Amendment because you've been pardoned, as you very well know. As the Supreme Court has been clear for a century and more, Brown versus Walker, 1896, when he has been pardoned, he may not stand upon his privilege.
Well, Dr. Fauci's attorneys think the pardon may not cover everything. There could be some state or local charges that are brought against Fauci that the pardon doesn't cover, so he pleads the fifth. Personally, I'd like to see Dr. Fauci be given total immunity at this point so that he can feel free to answer these questions, because the American people do deserve to have answers to these questions. We do deserve to know what he knew at the time and what the government knew at the time, what the administration knew at the time. It's too important to just say, oh, they're out to get me for political reasons, or Dr. Fauci, was misleading us so he could be rich and famous, and he was just focused on how many celebrities were talking about him. We need to get answers. We need to get to the bottom of this. This is not acceptable with Dr. Fauci just pleading the fifth and us having no answers moving forward. We need to do better than this. Let's go to the phone lines, 1-800-859-0957. Let's go to Tommy in Auburn Hills. Hey, Tommy, welcome to All Talk.
Yeah, thank you again for having me back. Yeah, you know, I think this Dr. Fauci guy's, I think he's bad. He's a bad dude, man. I think he should serve time in prison. You know what? When I, you know, I've been an asthmatic since 1996, and it's always been under control. And when we got COVID, all of a sudden, you know, Fauci's in control. And he talked me into getting a shot. Then I got the second shot. And the booster, I got the three shots. And it's, you know what? My asthma went from controllable to now I can hardly breathe. And I blame it on those. I blame it on that damn vaccine that Fauci made us take. I think he's a bad dude, and he lied. He lies everywhere. I think he should be in prison. That's my opinion.
Thank you, Tommy. I appreciate you listening. I appreciate you calling. Thanks so much. Let's see. John in Canton sees it the other way. John, welcome to All Talk.
Yeah. Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, I think that they're just trying to play gotcha on him. He's already testified to all these questions in front of them, you know, years ago. And now they want him to play it back just so they can try and maybe make him mix up an answer or something. But, you know, at this point, you know, really, they've already heard it all from him. So, you know, what are they trying to do?
Thanks, John. I appreciate the call. Appreciate your thoughts on this. I don't feel like we have all the answers. I feel like we need more investigating or more sit downs, you know, with Fauci or others. There are so many unanswered questions about COVID. I think we're very, very far from having the truth. I don't know if we'll ever get the truth, but I think there are a lot of problems, a lot of questions that we need to continue to dig into. Let's go to Robert in Detroit. Robert, welcome to All Talk.
Kevin, thanks for taking my call real quick, man. This is a 100% performance for the old messed up Republicans before the midterm elections. They've been so stinky ever since Donald Trump's been in office that, you know, they think that this is going to be like the guy said, I gotcha. Man, don't nobody give a damn about what Dr. Fauci wrote in his book when the president is out here telling people to hell with your daycare. We can't do that. With your Medicaid.
Thank you, Robert. We're up against the clock. It's All Talk. I'm Kevin Dietz. It's All Talk on a Thursday morning. I'm Kevin Dietz coming to you from the Golden Tower of the Fisher Building. Shanelle Jackson is running as a Democrat in Michigan's 12th district. She says she's running to improve affordability, strengthen public education, expand access to health care, and advocate for working families across the district. Shanelle Jackson joins us now. Good morning. How are you?
Good. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. How's the campaign going?
It's going great. Everywhere we go, man, we're just received with love. It's been really, really positive. And we're out here. We're outside, as I like to say, knocking doors, talking to folks, meeting them where they are, and learning what they want to see from their congresswoman.
That's good. Is it hard to differentiate yourself from other Democrats that are running? We have the primary, so people are going to pick a Democrat to go forward into the general election. Is it hard to differentiate yourself?
No, not at all. You know, what we're hearing from a lot of folks, particularly African-American women, is their, you know, great disappointment in Ms. Tlaib for her failure to support and endorse Vice President Kamala Harris when she was a Democratic nominee. Many Black women feel like they were slapped in the face, and it's opened their eyes to policy lack. And other things that they feel like, you know, Ms. Tlaib has represented. You know, other folks, when we talk to them, acknowledge and understand that she's not been an effective policymaker. I was an effective policymaker when I was in the State House. I'm not a career politician. But when I was there, I passed a lot of laws, substantive laws, on foreclosure reform, sex trafficking, criminalizing that, laws that help protect seniors that are in adult care facilities, all these things. $423 million brought back into the departments that needed it during the Great Recession and into the city of Detroit. So folks, you know, who recognize her policy ineffectiveness, look at me and my candidacy as a positive thing. And so it's been great. It's not hard to discern between the two of us.
What's the strategy when you're up against somebody with so much money in their campaign fund?
Man, it's hard because you hear her say, you know, oh, I'm against money in politics, but she's got a lot of PAC dollars. And that's okay. I mean, what we've been doing is telling our story. As I said, she did a lot of the work for us by making that grave miscalculation and supporting the uncommitted movement, which many of us believe brought us to the doorstep of Donald Trump. But that being said, I mean, we just really are focused on telling our story and ultimately getting our message out, and it is received very well. We also have seen polling on this race that shows that when the voter is reminded, the primary voter is reminded of the fact that Ms. Tlaib made this misstep, 68, that's almost 7 out of 10 primary voters switched their vote, switched their support from her. And that's across the district, no matter the race, because this is very important for Democrats. And, you know, she helped create the circumstance we're in today. So we talk about that a lot. And, you know, obviously when you're running against that much money, you've got to be, you know, out there hitting hard. And we do that with the resources that we have. But we also talk a lot about why it's good to make an investment in me and the accomplishments that I had as a leader in the legislature. Now as a person in the private sector.
We're talking with Shanelle Jackson, Democratic candidate for Michigan's 12th district. Tell us a little bit about the district and what the concerns are for folks who live there.
Man, everywhere we go, it's a similar circumstance. So, you know, the United Way reported this year that 43% of people living in Metro Detroit are either poor or severely struggling. 68%, 7 out of 10 African Americans that you see every day walking down the street or whatever, at work, whatever, 7 out of 10 of those folks are poor or severely struggling. 51% of all of the kids that live in Wayne County are poor or severely struggling. And so these are epidemic level numbers. And so the number one thing we hear when I talk to folks that live in the 12th is affordability. We can't afford to live. We can't afford housing. We can't afford to operate. We know that children that are raised in poverty statistically have a 50% greater chance of living in poverty as an adult. And so folks, maybe they don't know those numbers, but they have those fears, concerns, and worries for their children. They want leadership that's focused on them. Our current member focuses a lot of her energy on issues and struggles of people on the other side of the world. What I hear from folks is that they want leadership that's focused on their block, on the price of housing, on the cost of gas, on the cost of groceries. And they don't feel like they're getting that level of energy and hunger and desire from their current member of Congress. And so that's the number one thing we hear about, because folks are statistically, they're struggling, and it's real.
What are some things that you could do if elected to help with that for this large number of poor and struggling people?
Well, the first thing I want to do is, you know, work on something that is called the benefits cliff. The benefits cliff is basically when a person is receiving assistance, getting some help, but they get a small incremental raise on their job, and then they're kicked out of assistance, which ultimately perpetuates the problem. So one of the things that I want to do is close the benefits cliff for folks. The other thing I want to work on, you know, there are a lot of policies that are proposed and some have passed that help folks that are poor, and that is good. But there is not a lot of policy to help the working class. We hear a lot about the middle class, but I'm from a working class family that lives check to check most of my life. And that's the person that the United Way is identifying who one thing could throw their whole life off, you know, one repair, one whatever could do that. And so I'd like to propose a working class tax credit to help those families that are on the cusp so that they can save some resources and keep them in their home or maybe invest them so that they can grow their opportunity to have some sort of savings and some wealth in their family. The other thing that I know that I can do immediately is build some of the relationships that our current member has not done. You know, Ms. Tlaib alienates folks all over the country, also within her Democratic caucus and certainly with folks on the Republican side, and then also with the businesses, small and large, in our market. One of the things that we know statistically can help change and transition communities is when there are public and private partnerships. But you've got to have relationships with these companies and organizations. They're looking for opportunities to invest in job training, to partner with the cities, they want to pour back into the communities that they're based in. But they don't have that opportunity if they can't talk to their elected leaders, build out relationships. And so we know, we've seen it all over the country in other markets that had strong poverty. We see where public-private partnerships can get an investment from the private sector in job training so that government is paying less and put people to work in real jobs that can transition their lives and break these generational curses of poverty and struggle. So those are three things that I'd work on first when I get there to address those issues.
Thank you so much for sharing that. Can you share your website where people can find out more about your campaign as we get close to Tuesday's vote?
Sure. They can learn about me through all of the social media, by the way. We're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, Twitter. I've got some great videos that speak to who I am. Please definitely go to social. They can also go to my campaign website, which is ChanelleJackson.com, ChanelleJackson.com. And I'd love to hear from you. One of the things I say all the time is this is not my seat. I hear my opponent always call folks her residence or these are my people. Mm-hmm. I don't own you. This is our seat. And so I need you to step up with me to help figure this thing out. And so when I get elected, I need to hear from folks before and after so that collectively can change this thing for Detroit.
Chanelle Jackson, Democratic candidate for Michigan's 12th District. Good luck. The vote is Tuesday. That's going to do it for All Talk. The great Paul W. Smith in Focus is next.